Welcome, boys and girls, children of all ages. It's time for Zip the Ghost Egg to Frighten Ghostly Bear Grizz Eggs and the Cafe and the making of the podcast. And my name is Mike.
What are you, is this like your Bill Cosby?
And then I'm going to make it
the pudding pops. So
and then we make a podcast.
Yeah. Hey, guess what? Clayton and I went and saw Batman.
So my wife said maybe you guys should do like a spoiler-filled or a spoiler-free episode, and then next week do like a spoiler-filled episode. I was like, no.
Shut up, Natalie.
I'm like, listen, you don't tell us how to run this podcast.
That's right.
I'll turn this podcast around right now.
Pipe down, Clayton. Let me speak to your wife. We went and saw The Dark Knight Rises, and we saw it in IMAX, which is a new type of movie experience they have, where the screen's too big for your eyes.
Yeah, IMAX. I never saw it before.
That's right. I thought it was going to be a supermodel from the 90s that we were going to be seeing it with. Turns out her name is Iman.
Right.
She has nothing to do with IMAX.
And you were really, really upset about that. And then you thought you were going to see Heidi Klum, and then Seal showed up. So it was a whole weird time at this theater. But it was actually a big theater. We saw it in a pretty we sort of met in neutral ground.
That's the only way our attorneys allow us to meet.
Right. Equidistant from your house and my house. We met at a theater I'd never been to before, but that thing was massive. And it had sort of like that throwback appeal, you know, where it had a lot of like Godfather posters in the lobby. You noticed some interesting posters that I didn't even see.
Right. Yeah, they just had random older movie posters scattered around the whole place, which at first I thought meant that these movies were being re-released. Like, for example, in September, Finding Nemo is being re-released. So I was looking around, and I just thought, they can't be re-releasing all of these.
Like the Rocketeer was one of them.
Right. I love that Rocketeer poster. I think it's a Dave Stevens piece. It might be Dave Stevens. Do you know this weird bit of trivia? The Rocketeer's love interest, you know, is designed to evoke Betty Page, the pinup model of decades ago, you know?
Mm-hmm.
The, I don't know, famous/infamous Betty Page. And the guy, you know, the artist, Dave Stevens, the creator of The Rocketeer, forgive me if I'm not getting part of this information right, you know, he did that, you know, it was kind of his homage to her because he's infatuated with her. Well, he actually ended up tracking her down, and I believe they briefly had, like, a relationship together. I think that was kind of kept, like, kind of hush-hush within the comic book industry because she was in her 70s or 80s when Dave Stevens finally hooked up with her.
Weird. But, she's like, hey, lucky for me, here I'm at the retirement home, and you know, I'm not getting any young blood. People don't care about my old films, and then suddenly this guy shows up who's in his he's in his 20s and wants a little action. Of course Granny's going to give it to him.
I guess so.
Would Granny turn it down?
I don't know that type of information, but you know, she's mentally disturbed. That's probably the most delicate way of putting it, or friggin' nuts. one or the other. I don't know how you want to put it. I don't know how we got off on that. We got off because of the Rocketeer poster. And correct me if I'm wrong, right? The Rocketeer was in 89, just like the Dick Tracy movie was, right? And the first Batman we ever saw together.
Quick to Wikipedia.
Dick Tracy might have been 1990, now that I think about it. But Batman.
1991.
Batman.
1991.
Oh, okay. So, not quite. But in there. Really, Batman opened that up. I don't know that Dick Tracy movie would have been made in the way that it was, and certainly The Flash never would have stumbled onto CBS the way he did if not for the 1989 Batman movie, which is the first Batman film that Clayton and I saw together on opening day, which started this tradition now. Over the last 23 years, we've seen all 7 Batman movies on opening day together.
Yeah, it is unprecedented. We've, despite our long distances, somehow managed to see these things. And before we move on to Batman, I'm just looking at the Rocketeer IMDb page. And the guy who played the Rocketeer, did you know this? I mean, I don't know if it's been a while since we've been aware of this, but is this Billy Campbell?
That is the name of the actor, yeah.
Who plays the Rocketeer. Of course, and I didn't know this, he's the same Billy Campbell, of course, from The Killing.
Oh.
He plays
he's the senator or whatever. He's the city councilman.
He's the city councilman running for mayor.
Wow. Wow. Okay.
Wow, I didn't even know that. And I can't. Why can't I think of his name? Daryl? Is that his name in the show? Daryl?
I don't know. But now that you say it, yeah. Oh my God! It's just, you know, aged accordingly.
Darren Richmond.
Mm-hmm.
He's the city councilman from The Killing. I didn't realize that. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. I just glanced at him. He's like much younger. He still has that same sort of chiseled chin to him.
Right. Yeah. He still has his leading man good looks.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. Back to Batman. We.
Right now, Batman is a superhero.
Right. He has no superpowers.
Mm-hmm. So he's been around for a really long time, right? I mean, good grief.
So we got a lot of people commenting in our Twitter stream, Grizzly Bear Cafe, that they, of course, were going to see the film. They wanted to know what we thought of it. I hope at this point most people have had a chance to see it.
Because if not, you're going to want to turn this podcast off right now.
People wanted to know.
Here we go.
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be spoiler filled. So if you have not seen the film yet, obviously wait until you see it, because there are quite a few spoilers ahead as Mike and I digest
just
this film.
Time shift. You're listening to The Grizz until after you've seen The Dark Knight Rises. Hey, now let's say this up front about this. I don't know if you saw this, but did you catch that Warner Brothers is not releasing? They did not release the box office numbers. Did you hear this?
Right, out of respect for the victims and the individuals involved in the horrible shooting in Aurora, Colorado, they're not gloating with some numbers.
No, I think that's crap. I think that's real crap from Warner Brothers. I think that's retarded. You're not releasing your box office numbers out of respect to the victim. What is it? What do those two things have to do with each other? They have nothing to do with each other. Now, I will say this, of course. The horrible, horrible tragedy of Aurora, Colorado, with the shooter James Egan Holmes, who went into the theater. If you didn't catch wind, I understand it's been the topic of some conversation. He went in, he's deranged, you know, he thinks he's the Joker or whatever, and he opened fire in a theater. He killed 12 people, he injured another 58 people. This is horrific. But releasing your box office numbers, I there's no correlation here. You know what I mean? Like, if you were going to say, one thing Warner Brothers did do is that they moved the premiere some places in the wake of the tragedy, and they had various justifications for it, which I thought were sound. Some of the things that they said were reasonable. I think, like, the things that Christopher Nolan came out and said, these were responsible choices to make. These were the right things to say in the wake of this horrible, horrible tragedy, which, because this one nut decided to go into a midnight screening of their movie, The Dark Knight Rises, and because he's deranged enough to think that he's the Joker, these filmmakers and film studio really had no choice. But the idea that you're not releasing your box office numbers, and they're just holding it for one day. They said, we're going to delay the release of our box office numbers for one day out of respect. Like, what?
Yeah, I could understand if you're going to do it for a week. Hey, look, we don't want to gloat about numbers. The president's coming to Colorado. It's unseemly for us to gloat about the amount of money we raked in about this movie about which there's been so much tragedy and now associated. They canceled the premiere in Paris, of course. Yeah, as you pointed out, Christopher Nolan came out and made comments. Christian Bale came out and made comments. But for one day, it's almost as if – I don't know that people would have even realized it or paid much attention to it if you just would have released them. But now that you said you're going to withhold them for a day, it almost calls more attention to it.
Right. Like, what an empty gesture.
Do it for a week. Just be like, hey, you know what? We're not going to talk money at all for this next week. There's plenty of time for that. Well, let's just hold it off for a week. And I could see that it seems a little unseemly to be like, hey, by the way, we made, you know, $150 million this weekend.
Right, but they don't have to boast about it. Every other studio announces what their box office was no matter what happens over the weekend. You know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like after 9/11, everyone was like, if I wake up tomorrow and the box office numbers are out, I don't know how I'm going to make it through the day.
Right.
Like, what?
Right. Oh, Warner Brothers released their earnings this week. Right. Don't they have any respect for
right.
I mean,
the terrorists have truly won, Clayton, when the box office receipts come out the week after 9/11. It's absurd. It is absurd, I think. Now, I also think this is absurd. I don't know if you've seen this kind of stuff about all this stuff about the political agenda of The Dark Knight Rises, which I think is equally absurd. This is from a review in the publication Salon, which, if you can't tell by its name, is probably pretentious crap. The reviewer wrote, just as so many 1980s pop culture products reflected the spirit of the Reagan Revolution's conservative backlash, we're now seeing two blockbuster genre-shaping products not so subtly reflect the Tea Party's rhetorical backlash to the powerful Occupy Wall Street zeitgeist. Does anything about that quote have anything to do with The Dark Knight Rises? I don't think it does.
No. And furthermore, there was, of course, some question about the agenda or the political agenda of the movie by some prominent pundits who had made light of the fact or thought that Bane was created just to trump Mitt Romney, who has, you know, was the CEO of Bain for so many years.
Right. Rush Limbaugh came out and said that he thought it was a deliberate anti-Romney dig, which is crazy because Chuck Dixon came up with Bain 20 years ago.
Right. Was it 1993 or so?
Yeah, exactly. Here's what I want to say about we've now seen it all, right? We've seen Christopher Nolan tell the complete story. And while, of course, they've left the door open to come back, you know, they said if they come up with a good story and everybody's in agreement. But for the most part, it would seem that this is going to be the walking away point, right? They even refer to it in interviews. Even Christopher Nolan himself calls it a trilogy, right? So that would be three parts. We've seen the story from start to finish. And what he's done really, really well here, I think, is make a very, very credible, real-world Batman. And it escalates as it goes, right? Batman, you must watch them in order, especially because, in my opinion, this last one ties up everything so very neatly. It is very neat storytelling in that way. In Batman Begins, he lays this groundwork. How could you believe that this otherwise outrageous concept could exist in the real world? And he makes it so believable.
Right.
And then the stakes really escalate in the second one. In The Dark Knight, when they introduce the Joker, the stakes are really raised, right? It's a much larger scope than what you have in Batman Begins. And that and he really follows through on that general premise of escalation. And that's what you get in The Dark Knight Rises. The stakes are so much higher. And even though, if you were to just describe it, you know, like some of what goes on in the movie to someone, you would think that is so unrealistic. But in the context of the universe that Christopher Nolan has created for his Batman and the surrounding characters to populate, it's very, very credible. And the fact that it does kind of take advantage of things that have happened in the world over the last couple of years, you know, this kind of like the mob justice thing and that sort of thing, I felt it was incredibly realistic. Despite the fact that, you know, if you were just to kind of describe it in broad strokes to somebody, they'd say, oh, that's what happens in that? I don't believe that.
Right. Right, and it becomes epic. People were describing – I had thrown this out on Twitter. I said, you know, in one word, describe what you think Dark Knight Rises will be. Some people said, oh, it might be boring. Other, you know, said, epic was one of the words that I kept seeing repeated. And I think they were right. I mean, and of course, the stakes were enormous, right, for Christopher Nolan, who I think really elevated the superhero genre to an incredible degree. And certainly The Dark Knight was an epic film in its own right. Mm-hmm. So how do you take that and then outdo it, you know, mm-hmm. or take it to the next level? And I didn't know that it was going to be possible. And I have to say, and we'll dive into this in just a moment. I think we're already a few minutes into the show, maybe we should pause here and we'll come back and start getting into the meat of this. But, you know, the casting and all of the pieces that we were sort of mocking and worrying about early on, I think made sense, you know, mm-hmm. at least in my opinion. Well, I can't wait to hear your thoughts. And, you know, it's interesting because after the movie, it was pouring down rain. You had to run. I had to run. So we didn't get a moment's chance to talk after mm-hmm. the film. So this is the first time you and I have had a chance to actually comment about the film. So So anyway, we will do more of that in a moment.
We'll do some commenting. This is very true. That's what we do chiefly on this program. Yeah, let's pause for a moment and thank one of our great show sponsors. These folks have been with us for quite a little while, and we hope that they will continue to be with us. That's only possible when you go over and visit them. I'm talking about our friends from Cobra Electronics. When you visit their website, cobra.com, you're going to find an incredible array of technological innovations to simplify your life. One of them that I make use of every time I'm on the road, and I am all but a professional road tripper these days, is the Cobra Eye Radar System, which makes me a safer and more alert driver. And certainly the people that ride with me appreciate that. I appreciate it most of all when I'm traveling by myself, because I just make the voice on it really loud, and it's like someone shouting at me as I'm driving and telling me what to do. And I never have to worry about dozing off at the wheel.
Right.
I've also noticed, as I had recently remarked to some people, I am so the guy that used to get, like, a speeding ticket every year.
Right.
And that has not happened. I've had nothing along those lines happen to me since I got a Cobra Eye radar system. So not only is it going to make you safer and more alert, it might actually end up saving you a couple bucks as well. They've got professional-grade GPS. They've got marine navigation stuff, CB radios over there. They are the makers of the Cobra Tag, which is a wonderful gift any time of year. And when you go over to Cobra.com, one thing you really should do, because they update this section of their site all the time, check in the specials section. You'll find sometimes a buy one, get one free offers so that you can pick something up nice for yourself when you're gift shopping for someone else. You can also find deep discounts on their most popular items when you check in that specials section, and it's updated all the time. They've got great demo videos. They've really done an outstanding job over there. Go and see what our friends Cobra Electronics are all about. I'm certain they've got something that will appeal to you over there, and we couldn't make this program every week and deliver it to you free without them.
We thank them so much for their support of this show. Thanks. Mm-hmm. They cover the bandwidth costs here and website hosting and all that, so we appreciate that. We wouldn't be able to do it. So, let's dive into it. So, first of all, Matt Mahler wants to know, was the Superman teaser trailer in the front of the Dark Knight Rises screening? And indeed it was.
Yes, it was. Now, Clayton was out getting chicken fingers and right. curly fries while this was airing, but I did watch it.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was pretty good. No, I came back in, I was so furious because the food line was taking forever, and it was just like, oh, I can't miss any of these previews. Hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. And I rushed back in as that, what was the name of that like Ghostbusters style?
With Ben Stiller, and it's like The Watch or something.
Yeah,
is, right?
They go after aliens, and who else is in it?
Right. The guy from the It crowd is in it.
Yeah.
The IT
Iotti,
crowd.
Yeah, James Iotti.
Right.
I think.
God help you pronouncing his name. You know, every time I see him, no matter what role, and he's a very, very funny guy, but I'm always like, I wish that was Jermaine from Flight of the Conchords. Like, for some reason, like, I just like, you could cast him in that role too. But yeah, it's Vince Vaughn, Ben Stiller, Jonah Hill, and the guy from the IT crowd. And it does look kind of funny for what it is, but wow, I'm so not going to that.
Right, so I'm glad that was up front. That was the first trailer, but yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, there were actually 11 before that that you missed. But
right.
Of the ones we saw, right, the James Bond Skyfall one looked awesome.
Yeah.
And I was just blown away. I haven't been excited for a Bond film. Like after I saw that trailer, I was like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
But the Man of Steel was the last one, and it felt like there was a million trailers. And I was just like, oh, God, I'm getting so impatient. Like, please, please. And then we saw that ugly new DC Comics logo come up.
Right.
And we were like, oh, it's the Man of Steel. And say what you want about, oh, they cast a Brit as Superman and all this other stuff. For whatever that was, 60 seconds of time, like, I was just like, oh, my God. And you had said to me when they screened that at Comic-Con, like, people were crying.
Right.
Like, if it really seems like, based on that, and, you know, it's easy for 60 seconds to make a little game of something awesome up your sleeve. It really does seem like this is the Superman movie everyone has been waiting for. Like,
right.
I got goosebumps watching
it. I did too. And, you know, it's funny. Someone summed it up well on Twitter in response to us having seen this. They wrote and they said it was did you guys catch the Deadliest Catch trailer? I mean, Man of Steeler trailer at the front of The Dark Knight Rises, mm-hmm. because it does look like an episode of the Deadliest Catch. Mm-hmm. You know, you see Clark Kent. Mm-hmm. On this like shoreline of this like fishing village,
right?
And he's like carrying like lobster crates, and he's mm-hmm. he's got like a fishing cap on, and he's presumably strong, right?
Mm-hmm.
But he's grimy, he's gritty. The it was certainly not like the colorful film stock we're used to seeing. The big Boy Scout, and it was like a darker. It almost looked like an episode of the Deadliest Catch, mm-hmm. and then flash to the end of it when. You see this him breaking like the sound barrier,
right?
In the full costume, shooting through the sky was just the coolest thing I think I've seen in a long time.
Yeah, so. they really so far it seems to have tremendous promise. And when it was over, it got like an ovation,
right?
In the theater. And let me say this too before we really get into this here with The Dark Knight. This a couple things drove me nuts these last couple days. Here's one of them. One. Don't buy just one stamp at the post office, people. Do not. Hi, what do you need? I need just one stamp. No, you're going to need more. Buy a sheet. Buy a roll. Don't buy just one.
Mm.
That. Two, Clayton saw this firsthand. Apparently, at times, I'm invisible. I had to, and finally it got to the point where I didn't care. Next to us in the theater, there was a girl and two guys, a group of three.
Mm-hmm.
And the girl was of average size, and the two males were overweight, to say the least.
Right, large,
very large men. And it would be difficult, given their girth, for anyone to get past them. But because, as is tradition, whenever Clayton and I go to the movies together, we must sit in the geographic center of the theater. I had to pass by these people on my way to the seat, and then later, as I went to get food, by them again, and then, of course, back into the seat. These two guys would not move when I attempted to get through. They just sat there immobile. Like, that's not correct. That's not how it works. When someone needs to get through you when you're at a concert or you're in a theater or wherever you are, you have one of two options, right? One is you do the awkward, I turn my legs a little sideways, which is never really enough space.
Right, because your knee always hits their knee.
Right. We should have no contact. Or, which is what I did when someone had to get past me, you stand up for a brief second so they can pass and then sit back down.
Right.
And yes, for like 1 second, someone's view is occluded, but that's it. These people, I said that to you. I said, I must be invisible.
Right.
They don't seem to want to move.
You're too thin. So, now, if you were one of their size, then they may have moved, or you would have crushed their foot when you stepped on it. I mean, they did the same thing for me when I came through. They didn't move at all.
No.
I mean, their knees were fully up against the front of the seat in front of them, and they didn't move. What I don't get is, how do you go to a movie and not have to go pee? Right. When I go to see a movie of this length, which, by the way, it's like a 2-hour and 45-minute film.
Right. And then, you know, that the trailers aren't part of that running time. So you're in the theater for like 3 hours.
Right. How do you not have to go to the bathroom?
And I don't know.
I don't get it. So they just sat immobile. And they were there a half an hour before I was, clearly.
Right. So one of two things. One, at that size, their bladders are so large, they could go days without going. Or two, they had diapers on.
Right.
But either way, after I had to do that a second time, that last time coming back, I have never stepped on people's toes as hard. And I want you to understand what I do. My living is made in professional wrestling, where oftentimes I step on and kick people. I teach other people how to step and kick on people. And I couldn't wait to crush these people's toes. Like, are you kidding me? Are you for the third time going to pretend that you don't see me trying to get past you here?
Now, maybe it's because you came back to the theater with a big box of chicken fingers and didn't offer them any.
Well, did you see? Like, they were covered in food. Like, it was, like, all over their shirts. Like, would you bring a picnic basket in here? Would you have a buffet? Like, I was so infuriated. Even the girl then, the last time, she didn't move. I actually heard her toes cracking under my shoes. That's how hard I was stomping on their feet. Like, is this how it's going to go? Because you don't realize the way I'm going to passive-aggressive go about this here. That was infuriating. That notwithstanding, and the incredibly slow service out at concessions, I will say this. I thoroughly enjoyed the movie. I thought it was great storytelling. I thought they just did everything right. Hans Zimmer, who I think has, in the same way Danny Elfman did back, you know, in the previous run of the franchise, he's come up with an unmistakable sound that will evoke Batman forevermore and yet is nothing like Danny Elfman's.
Right, and is nothing like, well, I should say in part is nothing like The Dark Knight, the previous film. There are of course, the when Batman makes his appearance, you get that incredible overture, which
but
is
But you
just,
want that. I don't want that to change. You know,
no,
you even you sense him coming. You know,
and I'm glad you brought up the music because this is something I wanted to talk about. I think it gets overlooked quite a bit in film reviews. I thought, you know, what I didn't like about the Amazing Spider-Man film was the score. I mean, one of the big things, I thought the score was completely forgettable.
Right.
And this, I thought, was just, again, epic in tone. I mean, there were parts where my whole body was vibrating from, like, the deep bass, you know, when Bane would make his appearance. And there were just or it was carrying a scene where, you know, when he's down in the pit and there are other scenes where it's just like this, it was reverberating through your body, you know, this. But there were scenes where, and I thought this was where he showed how good of a composer he is, the scenes with Catwoman.
Mm-hmm.
because he, you know, we know what he did with the Joker, which was like this screeching violin sound.
Right. It sounds like a razor dancing down the strings of a violin.
Right. And so now you have Catwoman and the scenes where Anne Hathaway is being playful with Bruce Wayne, and there's a lot of piano. You know, it's like mm-hmm. a fluttering of the keys of the piano, and it's like a dancing almost. And it's,
right.
And it was, you know, it might have been imperceptible, but to, you know, but it wasn't. It was. I don't know. I just thought it captured the essence of their little tango perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Hans Zimmer really has outdone himself on these three films, I think. And, you know, he's done tons and tons. He's got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, does Hans Zimmer. He's well recognized for his musicianship and everything else, and he's really outdone himself with this. It's incredible. It's masterful movie making and all around. And what I really like about this is, compared to the Avengers, and it's really difficult to compare these two, they are two totally separate movie experiences. This
right.
one is satisfying and fulfilling in its own way, and obviously they did a great job of teasing you, you know, even with that, like, you know, the fake spoilers that they floated out on Letterman a week ago or things like that. They've really done a great job of teasing you, and it comes down to this simple formula about storytelling. When you want people to be interested in something, this is the formula. It's as simple as this, and I learned this actually from a memo that they have at Pixar about their type of storytelling. Anticipation plus uncertainty. Hmm. That's the formula. And they did that masterfully with The Dark Knight Rises, the way they marketed it and everything else. And
yeah, because there were things – I mean, I was shocked. I mean, I was shocked by the ending.
Mm-hmm.
There were quite a few things I was shocked by in the film.
Right, you can really tell Nolan was smart to get the complete creative control when he did, because if not for that, I cannot imagine some of the things that they do in those last 15 minutes of the film he would have gotten away with.
Right.
Let me ask you this, because it's a long movie, a lot happens. Do you have a couple lines that you took away, like that were just like lines that really resonated with you in the movie, or like moments that kind of got stuck in the amber of your memory?
Yeah, in fact, well, one of them came from Bane. First of all, let me just say mm-hmm. this about
yes.
Bane. What an incredible job. And the brilliance of using that mask with that incredible voice. Mm-hmm. It was creepy because he's so brilliant, right? It's creepy because he's so normal. And it's creepy because it's a little amplified. And the way in which he talks, it's so calm. He has there's no fear in his voice at all. There was a scene where, of course, he's fighting Batman. The first scene where they actually fight each other. There was a scene where they met before, where he's on the rooftop. But this is the scene underground where he's in the fight with him, and Batman flips off the lights. Batman's trying everything in his arsenal to go at him, and he says, the darkness. You know, and he goes through this thing about the darkness. You think this is an advantage. I don't remember what the exact phrasing was. You think this mm-hmm. is an advantage, but I was born in the dark, you know, or something like mm-hmm. that. And it was just so eerie, and you thought,
yeah,
Batman has nothing left. He's got nothing mm-hmm. left in his arsenal right now. You know, it was just mm-hmm. this moment that hit me. That was one. What about you?
Yeah, in that same exact scene, as soon as the door locks and you realize that Catwoman's walked him into a trap, and part of it is this really pompous way that he sort of holds his vest. Like
right.
Bane's hands, he's always gripping his vest really high in a really unusual way that gives him like a sense of arrogance. He says, "Let's not stand on ceremony, Mr. Wayne."
Right.
And the way he said that was just like the eeriest thing. I also liked in the first act of the film, they just have this random scene where this newer beat cop character they introduced, John Blake, is with like a veteran cop who's been on the force for a while, and the lights begin to flicker, and the veteran cop says, "Oh, you're in for a show tonight."
Oh yeah.
And then you hear the Batman theme coming in, like you realize he's about to appear on screen. And something about the way that actor delivered that line really stuck with me. Like I really, really like that about it,
because that's the same guy who from Batman Begins. I went back because we bought my son the little tumbler. My wife, she was at the store, and she's like, I couldn't handle not getting them. They had the whole lineup of the die-cast Batmobiles.
Right.
And so she picked up the Tumblr version for him. So we ripped it out of the packaging. He was running a Batmobile, and he's running around the ground. And I said, you know, because he's never seen it on film. I said, well, let me see if I can find this. So I jumped on YouTube real fast on my Apple TV and jumped over and found just that scene, the Batmobile Tumblr scene from Batman Begins. So it's 4.5 minutes. I put that on. You see, you know, Commissioner Gordon saying, I got to get me one of those. And then the scene kicks off, right? Mm-hmm. And then it ends with him going into the Batcave, of course. But that scene, there's that one, that same cop who's mm-hmm. like underneath the underpass at one point and says, mm-hmm. and I recognized him right away when I saw him in The Dark Knight Rises, you know. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, I think that's the guy. And I'm sure one of them. But I think he said, well, at least just describe it to me. Right, he's asking it for, and I don't know. It's he's in one of those scenes, and I can't remember if that's that same guy. Just describe it to me, and then he says, "Never mind, I know I saw it." Or he's one of the guys that gets crushed, and he says, "It's a tank," mm-hmm. you know, and then it's driving over the city. So it's that same cop. But I love that line too. That was great.
Yeah, they really. It's interesting when they're, you know, this late in the story, and there's nothing really to go over. Now they do. They do end up telling you an origin story for Bane. They do as well for another one of the characters that's in the film, Miranda Tate. And they kind of, I mean, not really, but they give you enough backstory on Catwoman that you understand.
Now, I thought that was brilliant.
Her motives. But they didn't really go back and give you the full-on Catwoman thing, because I don't know that you need it.
Right, and that's what was so great. You and I were, first of all, let's go back. I mean, how many Grizzes have we talked about? Oh, Anne Hathaway.
Right,
so,
yeah.
I want to give her due right now. I thought she did an excellent job. Mm-hmm. I thought she showed great sort of bipolar brilliance in going from, oh, really? Can I go up and see him? To having total female control over someone, mm-hmm. right? Where she you know, she has her total wits about her, but she's mm-hmm. playing dumb for the sake mm-hmm. of, you know, getting in, right?
Right.
And I was totally convinced. I thought we were going to see the origin of her when she's the waitress at the beginning of the film, right? Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, we're going to learn she's going to become Catwoman, or she's going to, whatever, it's going to unfold. But I didn't see that coming at all. When she suddenly jumps out the window and he's like sort of bedazzled by her.
Right.
You know, I just thought she did a great job. And furthermore, she delivered some great lines. There were some great lines where she's with the congressman.
Mm-hmm.
She gets the one up on the crime boss, of course, or she on Daggett. You know, and she manages to get the drop on him by using his cell phone. So there were some great lines delivered by her as well.
Yeah, she did really well, and I think that was one of the things we were most nervous about. Like, oh, is she just going to ruin this entire thing here? It's interesting to note about some of these characters. Like, Catwoman is never referred to as Catwoman in the entire film. The closest thing is that they show some newspaper headlines that I think Alfred finds relating to her, where she's referred to as a cat burglar, and they call her the Cat. They don't hit you over the head with it.
Right.
You know, like
it's not like Batman Returns where, oh, Cat. Well, actually, she does say Cat got your tongue at one point, right? When she puts the foot up to his mouth. But mm-hmm. there's no over and over in Batman Returns. Remember, she's mm-hmm. she starts licking herself at one point. She's like cleaning herself.
She's not overtly feline. Like, she has this gizmo she wears on her head, like when she's cracking safes and things like that kind of work like goggles. And when they're up, they vaguely resemble cat ears.
Right.
But they don't hit you over the head with it. And it's interesting in that I think all the really big spoilers are, like I said, in the last 15 minutes of the film or whatever. But it's interesting since it's clear Nolan is not entirely averse to the idea of Batman having a partner that helps him, that of all the characters they could have chosen, they went with Catwoman in this. But she does hold her own. Anne Hathaway does hold her own. And, you know, Nolan sings the praises in every interview of Tom Hardy. Mm. And considering that, you know, his mouth and nose are completely obscured by the mask of Bane that he wears, it is a testament to what a good actor he must be, because he emits such a presence on the screen as Bane. And all he really has to do, you know, he's got his eyes, you know, and like his forehead to tell you the story with.
Right.
And that's really about it.
So I got a question for you, because I don't know the answer to this. Is the voice of Bane, is that Tom Hardy, or is it someone else that they've sort of like James Earl Jones did up, like Star Wars, Darth Vader style, right?
Mm-hmm. I think we would have heard that if it wasn't his voice.
Because I know, I mean, Tom Hardy is, I think he's Australian. Am I wrong about that? He's either Australian or British. I mean, he certainly has an accent of his own. But again, Bane, the character, is Brazilian.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't know that this version of Bane was Brazilian. He just had a little flair. Right. And the voice is so eerie. I was trying to describe it to my wife when I got home, but that was the eeriest part. And he's just so just the way he, well, we're going to go down here, and if you can't find me, well, you'll die. You know, he's just, like, very matter-of-fact about things. And
You know, they use that contrast, and not that Nolan's the first to ever do this, where his speech is very proper, and it's contrasted by the fact that he's so brutish, you know, that that he's a physical brute. What's interesting, I went back and did some reading about Bane, is that, and I don't remember this from the Nightfall story, which is the name of the arc where they introduce Bane in 1993, climaxing in him breaking Batman's back, is that he was always super intelligent.
Right.
And I do not remember that about Bane from the original book at all. Like, I don't know if they just introduced that a little late in the story. To me, he was always just like Batman's version of Doomsday, this mindless hulking monster that was a physical match. Because, you know, of course, in the Superman books, who was ever really a physical match for Superman?
And, see, and he, I do remember that, because I you know, I had the Nightfall series. I don't know if you had it or not, but I was certainly deep into the books. I do remember him being wildly intelligent, which is why it bothered me in the, was it Batman and Robin?
Right, when he's just like, he's like the Hulk with a mask on.
He doesn't even speak. You know, he's just like this brute that's filled with gas.
Right.
Like that guy whose foot you stepped on.
Indeed, indeed. So, you know, Bane, when they announced Bane was going to be the villain, I think all of us were a little let down, because Bane is really no one's favorite Batman villain, right? Batman has the best rogues gallery in all of comicdom. I would have so much rather seen the Riddler. I could have made you a list of 10 other villains I would have rather seen before we saw Bane, but I can't imagine how they would have done this without him. And they do tie it back together in a really neat way to the first two movies and all that. It kind of comes full circle. He's the perfect choice, of course, because he is a physical match. He, in fact, Batman's overmatched by him, which is what makes Bane so compelling. And is he is as smart as Batman, and he's stronger. You know, you struggle to see a way for Batman to triumph in this, and that's what it needed, right?
Right.
Because Batman, he is at his best, really, when he is prepared, and they've put him in a situation here that he couldn't possibly be prepared for against Bane. And then just it seemed like every time that he starts to get a leg up, there's another twist in the plot, and Batman is in trouble again. And I thought it just made for a great movie.
Just as he's being defeated again, or he's being, you know, his back is about to be broken, he could not feel any worse off, he's got nothing left in his utility belt to fight Bane, you know, he creates this explosion, and suddenly all of his tumblers and his arsenal collapses. And then you realize, in that collapse, oh my God, like everything we believed about the secrecy of Bruce Wayne as Batman has collapsed. Bane's fully aware of it.
Right.
You know, it's... He's not standing on ceremony at all. We needed access to your arsenal, you know.
Right.
He just collapses the bottom of his bat arsenal, so he's got all the tumblers and the secret R&D department that no one even knows about, but he and Lucius. Mm-hmm. Suddenly they have full access to it. These guys are climbing up into it, and then they're using these tumblers to drive around the city. I thought in that moment, my God, not only is he defeating Batman, he's defeating the secrecy of Batman. And he's defeating the symbol of Batman, and at the same time, and how can he come back from this? So, you know, I thought, and there was a scene, of course, when you had to go to the bathroom, you got up and you left during one of the more monumental moments in the film.
I did. I broke some toes.
I think this was the beginning of the third act of the film. We both had to vacate our bladders. And I made it back into the theater in time to see the great Bane exposition, where he preaches to the city of Gotham about what he's intending to do to the city now. And it was, you know, pretty awe-inspiring. I couldn't help, though, but feeling that there's going to be like a director's cut, of course, of this film. And a lot of what we'll see is in that third act. I felt like... This is one of my little criticisms of the film. The third act felt a little rushed to me. Like I could have sat for another 20 minutes to see more of the desolation of this experience, or to see more of why Catwoman would have enjoyed this environment. Because, you know, as her friend laments at one point, you know, you like this, or this is what you wanted, right?
Right.
And I would have liked to have seen more of that experience. You know, we see the cops down on the underground. We see the boys' club. But we don't see – well, maybe we see some of that. I don't know. I just would have – we saw some of the courtroom appearances, right? We see Dr. Crane handing out verdicts and so forth. But maybe I just – it's a small criticism. I would have liked to have seen more of that. And I felt like maybe at 2 hours and 45 minutes, that was the area they had to cut a little bit out of.
Right. I would have liked to have seen more of the Tea Party backlash against the Occupy Wall Street zeitgeist in the third act. That's what I want to which is absolutely bogus. Yeah, I'm disappointed I missed that because, especially in the trailers, obviously that whole thing in the football stadium was like a centerpiece of the movie. Right. And like, I got back right at the end of that. And I was like, whoop, I think I missed a big chunk there. I liked the fact that Bane, he espouses this kind of rhetoric. And I thought it was really well written. Like, I thought his motives were really well written. And it was clear. I thought that, you know, they almost gave it away. Not that people didn't realize when, you know, the list came out or whatever, and Liam Neeson has a cameo in the movie. But when he says, I'm Gotham's reckoning, like, clearly he's an agent of Ra's al Ghul, right?
Right.
Like, that is the exact same thing that Ra's al Ghul says in the first one. And it's interesting to see how, you know, they sort of extrapolated this easily digestible rhetoric into what it became. And I also want to say this. One of the other things I was really worried about with this movie was the Bat, new vehicle.
Batwing, even though it's just called the Bat.
Right. He doesn't get the Batmobile back.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's not like, oh, he just goes and picks up another tumbler and paints it black. That never happens. He's really stuck with the Bat Pod and then this new thing that they developed, the Bat. When I first saw it in a couple of the trailers and everything, I just thought, I do not believe that thing. Like, it's ridiculous. But I did. In the movie, I believed it. The way they presented it and everything else, I did believe it. There are a couple moments where they push your ability to suspend your disbelief.
Right, I agree. I didn't feel that way in the first two films.
Right. Here's one of them. Batman took the time to smear some kind of flammable thing all over the bridge in the shape of the bat symbol, so that Commissioner Gordon could light it up and it would make a big flaming symbol to everybody. He had time to do that.
Right. I thought that was a cheesy moment. However,
I did too.
But I thought, okay, wait a minute. That's the one bridge that's not blown up.
Mm.
So that was. Did you catch that? I mean, that's kind of what
I
was able to say. Wait a second. That's where he wants everyone to be led to.
Mm-hmm.
That he's going to have them go over across that bridge, right? Or am I wrong about that?
No, I agree. I think you're right about that. But I just thought, I don't know. Like, Gordon and his men are about to be killed.
There's only like 11 hours left.
Right.
Like, you're going to go paint a bat.
Right. Real quick, I've got to just take one of these 11 hours and smear a bat symbol all over the bridge.
Right.
I didn't necessarily believe that. This was one of the other moments when, he needs to get back to the bat because Lucius needs something that's in it. And Lucius says, do you remember where you parked it? And what you're telling me is that for the last 3 months, this state-of-the-art weapon vehicle has just been parked in the same place.
Under a tarp?
Right, and no one found it? And yes, that's what they want you to believe, that we just put it under this tarp here and nobody found it.
And like, that he didn't escape that way. I mean, I don't know why he would have parked it there. Why he couldn't? As we noticed, he was able to go into the Batcave with it, right? He was able to land it on that little platform that Alfred,
right.
He was standing there talking to Alfred about. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there were some moments like that. I'm trying to remember one or few of the other moments in the film that wasn't able to suspend disbelief. I was a little bummed about, and the sort of thing you and I talked about before we saw the movie, we were worried that we wouldn't see enough Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And for 2 hours and 45 minutes, I don't know that I got enough Batman.
Right.
That's where Batman is – he's having – or Bruce Wayne's having to fix himself in this prison, or he's fighting the he's a recluse, so he's not Batman, so he has to come back to being Batman. But when he comes back, you get this sort of triumphant feeling again that he's back.
Sure. But I think they must have been at odds with the fact that they couldn't release a 4-hour movie. But like that scene where he's in the Batcave and he just puts that like mechanized knee brace on, and then all of a sudden he's okay.
Right.
Like, that's it. And like, you know what, I think maybe like 2 or 3 months of doing sit-ups here in this prison and I should be able to escape.
And take on Bane.
Right. And, you know, he even says in that scene where Catwoman's leading him to Bane, she says, these are no ordinary brawlers you're up against. And he says, neither am I. And yet, he just gets into a fist fight with Bane.
Like, right.
Batman is so much more than that. He's more than just a boxer. But that's what he does. He just fights Bane. Like, you can't tell me you didn't think to put something in that belt of yours. Like, maybe I have a bias towards 60s Batman a little bit, but I bet you there's something in that utility belt.
Right. And with a nod to the 60s Batman, I leaned over to you at one point in the film. I couldn't help but thinking, some days it's just hard to get rid of a bomb.
Right.
I mean, it's that circular bomb, right? And he's like running around the city with it. They're trying to get rid of this thing. They don't know what to do with it. And then Batman swoops in and is able to do something with it.
I was trying to say to you, too, I couldn't even get it out without laughing. And I wanted to make a reference to Egghead in the middle of it, and I couldn't even get it out without losing my composure, because he's so like the guy that doesn't belong in that Christopher Nolan universe. Like, you know, in the background, who's helping Bane? Oh, there's Egghead!
Right. Like. So, but it had the feeling of an epic film, and it's certainly a suitable end to this into this franchise. I couldn't help, though. It's amazing all of the moving parts of this. And I felt like maybe it was a little too crammed.
Mm-hmm. Definitely a lot of the reviews said the same thing. Too many new characters. It was too much crammed in.
And, you know, with the Lucius, I think some of the angles that had to do with, the Tate character, and then having Lucius involved in that way again, with some of this stuff, it felt a little crammed, but. Again, I think that's where maybe we're going to see like this epic release of these sort of director's cut of these films, where you're getting to see a lot more scenes for some of these things. And I have to bet that certainly this third film had a lot cut out of it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
One of the things I do really like about the job that Nolan's done all around is you feel like, and you know, what things he said in interviews, if you go back and look at some of the things he said before Batman Begins or right around the time that came out, like one of them was, I remember reading this piece about him, that they created the Rachel Dawes character because they felt like they couldn't do Harvey Dent justice and they needed a different attorney character. So they created Rachel Dawes. And yet, just a couple years later, he did a magnificent job with Harvey Dent in The Dark Knight. So it's hard to imagine, right? At one point, Christopher Nolan felt like that's a character he could never do. You also got the sense, you know, early on, Christopher Nolan came out at the beginning of the franchise and said, I want nothing to do with Robin. And two things about that. One, there's a terrific spoiler coming for you at the end of the movie, at the end of The Dark Knight Rises, if you've been waiting for even so much as a wink of that. And it's interesting how you can see that really informed the decisions that he made early on about Commissioner Gordon. That Gordon was really functioning a lot of times almost in the Robin-like role. Like, he's the one that's helping Batman along. And then when it gets to a point where Gordon no longer can do that, that's where Catwoman comes in.
Right.
And I think Nolan, more than anybody, really got the Gordon-Batman relationship right. Like, I've never... When do you ever care what happens to Gordon?
Right.
And you're so invested in Gordon in this trilogy. Like, and here's what's amazing about it. Like, you go back and you watch, you know, who is it? It's Alan Napier, right, who plays him in the 60s series.
Right.
Like, Gordon's incompetent. So is Chief O'Hara, right?
He's a
like,
fool. Right.
Right. Like, the first second anything goes wrong, they run to that bat phone and call Batman. It's like their police force is completely incompetent. By the way, this is one of the best lines ever written in the history of entertainment. The sum of the angles of that rectangle are almost too horrifying to contemplate. That's a real Alan Napier quote from Batman in the Movie in 1966. But Gordon's incompetent, right? Like, you get the sense in the previous Batman franchise, like in the first two when Burton was helming it, at least Gordon was somewhat compassionate, right? He was worried for his officers. He didn't want them in undue danger. He was trying to eliminate corruption. But by the time Schumacher takes over, Gordon's a buffoon.
Right.
Like, you remember he's, like, charmed by Poison Ivy at that auction. Like, he's like a stooge.
Who played Commissioner Gordon? Was it the same guy?
Pat Hingle.
So they kept the same guy.
Yeah. You know, that's a weird statistic about him. He's, like, the most – he has the most appearances. He and who played Alfred? Michael Goff. The two of them together are the ones with the most number of Batman movie appearances.
Four, right? Yeah, they did all four of them.
Exactly. They stayed true throughout that run. But in this, in Nolan's trilogy, one, Gordon is extremely competent, right?
Right.
And Gordon is ballsy. Like, he takes chances. And what's also interesting is Gordon never fails. Like, whenever it comes down to Gordon, You're never like, oh, Gordon gets it right, right? He comes through and Batman Begins, right? He's the one that has to drive the Batmobile in that scene at the end, right? He's got to derail the train in Batman Begins. In The Dark Knight, you remember when you and I saw that in that theater in New York City, it was like a raucous standing ovation when Gordon catches the Joker.
And pulls his mask off, right?
Right, when he pulls the helmet off and says, we got you. Like, the place stood up and went crazy, which was awesome. Like, when does Commissioner Gordon ever get a round of applause?
And then in this one with the bomb.
With the bomb, he comes through again. And Gary Oldman is so good. And which is crazy because, you know, he's typically cast as a villain.
Right.
There's all these movies where Gary Oldman is the villain. He's outstanding as Commissioner Gordon. And
he's British.
Right, which, you know, that's a big mark against him. And and along those lines, Michael Caine is like the heart of this movie, as he always – he's Bruce's conscience.
Right.
And he's amazing. Like that scene – I think that was like maybe – there were two moments where I really kind of felt like I was moved by the movie making of it, is that scene where they're on the staircase and they're having that – where he reveals that he burned the letter.
Right.
To try and spare him pain. And Bruce says to him, goodbye, Alfred. Like, you realize, like, how now he really is an orphan.
Right. Now he really is. He can't answer the door by himself. He doesn't even know what to do. He doesn't even know how to, like, open a, you know, turn on the power in his house. Like, it's just a – he's completely collapsed without Alfred.
Right. And you could see how devastating it is to the two of them with the – you know, what a bizarre relationship those characters have had over the years, right? Alfred is the surrogate father and – you know, Bruce feels betrayed by him and basically, you know, he's saying to him, he's saying, please don't hate me. And Bruce just says, goodbye, Alfred. And I was so moved by that. And then again, you know, of course, there are all these wonderful cinematic moments, right, that make the movie going experience what it is. But that moment at the end where he's leaving in the bat and the one kid, you know, it just seems they're always on the verge of just absolute it's like unbelievable hopelessness, and you see the bat coming out of Gotham City and that kid on the school bus says it's Batman.
Mm-hmm.
Like the way they played that was just they were very, very moving moments in this, and a lot of times it's easy to overlook that. You know, I think if you look at some of the other superhero films and the way they've been done, they lack those kind of moments, and that to me was as close as it got. I remember that moment when they stab Agent Coulson in The Avengers, and people yelled in the theater. They screamed. They were like, no!
Right.
They, in a weird way, like what they were able to do for Agent Coulson in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, like I think that was very telltale when we saw The Dark Knight. They were able to do that same thing for Commissioner Gordon, because when you thought they took him away from you, and then he does, he pulls that helmet off, and he's got the Joker, and he says, we got you.
Mm-hmm.
You realize like how invested you've become, that the experience is so immersive, the storytelling is so outstanding, that you care about these ancillary characters that in a lot of other films, right? If we were watching Batman and Robin and they killed Pat Hingle's Commissioner Gordon character, no one would have cared. You would not have cared for a split second. And yet, can you imagine the reaction of the audience in this one? And there were a number of times when you really did think this was the end. Like, I was like, they're going to kill Gordon in this one.
Right.
And thank God they didn't.
It was remarkable. Let's pause here and thank our next show sponsor here. How many have we thanked?
We've only thanked Cobra. We've only thanked Cobra for you.
Well, let's thank our friends over at Drobo this week. Mm-hmm. They have a whole new lineup of products. Here's the thing. Look, if you are one of these people who – and I think
are
it's
you a, one of these people?
Probably a majority – of people out there, right? I think only 7% of people actually back up anything anymore. That's a problem. So if you're one of these people who doesn't back up, right, all the photos you take, all the files that you keep, all of your documents that are important to you and your family. And in fact, I was talking with my wife about this the other day, which is I bet there's a whole generation of individuals who are going to grow up with, you know, certainly younger than us, but that are going to grow up not having lots of physical memorabilia. The way that we, you know, you might go through a box in your house and you'll say, oh, look at these photos or look at this old thing that I have from my childhood. You know, most of that stuff is going to become digital. People are going to scan things and keep it digitally. People are going to just get, you know, all of our photos these days are digital. Who has film anymore? I don't even think they make film anymore, right? Kodachrome stopped being used. So all of this stuff is moving digitally. Therefore, you need to have it backed up properly. Because God knows if your one computer that you have stuff backed up on dies, you're going to lose all that stuff. So I think, Mike, you're running like a Drobo FS in your house, right?
Right next to my tower, I run the Drobo FS, which I've got loaded up so that if my drive, you know, my hard drive were to fail or whatever, something would happen to it, I've got it backed up. And the system of drives, it's always shuttling the information around. So even if one of the drives in the Drobo for some reason would fail, it's on the other drives. You know, I'd have to have, counting my hard drive, I'd have to have four other drives simultaneously fail.
Right.
For my information to be lost. So especially given all the digital media that I keep, like my whole music library now is basically on my computer. And let me tell you this. If there is one chore that I would dread, it would be reloading my music library like into iTunes. Like I can't even imagine. It'd be like a month. I would just have to stop working.
Right.
That would be dreadful. I'm safe. I'm always protected because I've got a Drobo. And they've got new – they've got faster, they've got smaller, they've got slimmer, they've got lighter solutions, including that new Drobo Mini, which is portable. You can just pick it up and take it with you anywhere you go. You've got to see the line of new innovations that they've come up with. Go over and see them. They're no longer Data Robotics. They're just Drobo, Drobo.com.
Yeah, we love them. So some loose ends here with this film. I mean, I think the ending sort of rushed to the credits. There were some things that unfolded right at the end that maybe seemed a little too fast for me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we revealed some things. Obviously, there's a – where this particular franchise may or may not go in the future, is it done? Christopher Nolan has left the door open to saying he would be interested in, you know, possibly doing something again if the writing came to him and the muse came to him. And also Christian Bale said the same thing. But I think it's safe to say with the setup here at the end, it's not likely.
Right.
I don't see that happening, but I don't know. And I'm a little struck by – so well, there was some criticism, of course, of the ending of this film and the creative license that I think was taken with the characters.
Yes.
And I have to say I was a little put off by it too. I mean it works for the film. It works for the trilogy. And there was quite a bit of applause when we saw one scene with Alfred and Bruce Wayne at the end that everything was going to be okay. That was sort of that reassuring Batman moment that we needed to see as fans. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I felt like a little disappointed because for me what's always so compelling about the comic book is that there's always a chance Batman will be back.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't feel that way at the end of this film.
Mm-hmm.
Your take?
Yeah, they definitely took some creative license. There's no two ways about it. But I think we're willing to give Nolan a little rope here because he's handled everything else with such care.
Right.
And so in a way, you're kind of like, all right, I guess I'll let you slide here, Nolan.
Yeah.
You know, like he's built up some good social capital with us. And so we're going to let him slide. And I really did like where they left it because my fear was, you know, there's just like the habits of the movie studios and things like that, right? They really didn't go the way that they were. They deliberately tried to mislead you, right? They wanted you to think it was going a certain way, and they didn't go that way. And they left all the characters roughly where they would need to be for someone else to pick up and run with it. And that's kind of what you want, I think. You don't want to feel like there's a finite end to these characters. And because Batman, maybe, you know, Batman and Superman, of course, stick out first and foremost, they are the American mythology, right? Like, if you go back and you look at the myths of the ancient Greeks, it's not like, ah, yeah, you remember that Greek myth where they kill Zeus off at the end, and then some other guy brought him back later, you know, but it was like a different Zeus? Like, no, that doesn't happen. And the characters in our mythology, they need to be immortal for a certain reason, you know, and Batman is certainly the case of that. Perhaps Batman more than any of the others, because Batman is us. Batman is human. You know, a lot can be said about, and I think it was a huge blunder on the part of DC, the way they killed Superman and brought him back a year or two later, whatever that was. I didn't like the way that was handled at all. But Superman is not one of us, even though he looks like us, right? He's from the far-off planet. He's got superpowers. He is not one of us, despite all appearances, whereas Batman is. And I think it's really, really important that in terms of the storytelling, at whatever point, whatever writer, and the Nolans wrote this, his brother co-wrote it with Christopher Nolan, if I'm not mistaken, that when they are done, that they, you know, they do not leave the mythos in any worse state than where they found it. And I think that proves to be the case here. And it is. It's very, very satisfying in the end, I think.
And they did a great job, too, of – you talked about handling it with care. They certainly did because, you know, very often these films don't carry through to the next film and these types of movies, right? So there's very little consequence. So at the end of one big sort of epic film, we pick up like a few years later and who cares, right? Mm-hmm. We don't – whatever happened in that last film, yeah, we remember that, but this is a whole new story.
Right.
Right. What happened in that last film has consequences for this film.
Mm-hmm.
And Nolan was very aware of doing something. In fact, I heard a nice interview with him on NPR, I don't know, that someone sent me a few weeks ago before the movie opened, where he talked about at the end of the Dark Knight, you know, he asks to be hunted like a dog. He asks basically to take the fall for Harvey Dent, right? Mm-hmm. The city needs this. And of course, the Dent Act is then written, and we're seeing the consequences of all of these criminals being off the streets as a result of the Dent Act. And that Batman goes into this basic seclusion and retirement because he's not needed anymore. Mm-hmm. So for 8 years, he's out of commission since that film, right? I mean, that's the time period. I think it's like 8 years. I think, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken. So he's off the books. He's off the charts, right? He's not involved at all anymore. And the streets are cleaned up. All of these people are in Black Rock Prison. And it's very, very safe. Crime statistics have dropped. So Nolan made it a point of saying that we needed that to have consequence. Like, for all of this, all these people who died, all of this needed to have consequence. And the consequence was that the city was safer. And so mm-hmm. Batman wasn't needed. It was his goal to make Gotham safer, and he wasn't needed anymore. And so I thought that said that said boatloads about the type of filmmaker that Christopher Nolan is, and of course he and his brother who wrote this, that they really, really, really wanted this to be a complete trilogy and to not have any loose ends, but to really handle it with care from beginning to end.
Right. And I think it's going to be incumbent now on DC because, you know, Batman is – his continuity is sloppy. It's all over the place. And how could it not be, right? When you have a character that's as old as Batman is, you've got decades and decades, you know, what 73 years old Batman is or whatever it is now. The storytelling sometimes in the Batman comic books is a little slipshod. Mm-hmm. You know, even executives have said, you know, you never have to worry about what writer or artist you put on Batman because it'll sell anyway. And realistically, if you look at what the numbers of sales for print comic books, and even including digital comic books, are these days, versus the number of people that have seen the Batman trilogy by Nolan, if you were going to get people to take a chance on, you know, Batman as a comic book character as opposed to a movie character, this is the type of storytelling that you've got to live up to. And I think the fact that Nolan managed to at least keep his own continuity throughout this trilogy and respect that. Now it really is incumbent on DC, who I've been really down on since they did their new 52, which to me is just a publicity stunt to try and get new people interested, right? Like, I don't know if just the collective weight of having characters that are as old as they are, they just thought, let's throw out the baby in the bathwater and start fresh. But it's going to be difficult for them to keep up because Nolan really has set the bar now for that type of storytelling, and he's done it with their most identifiable character, Batman.
So can the same thing be done as he is now helming and is the overseeing producer on The Man of Steel? And if what we're seeing is good, I mean, is part of that, then I think we're excited about it. Certainly that trailer looked like it was heading in the right direction, mm-hmm. giving it a grittiness, a realness to it, trying to make Superman in some ways real for us.
Yeah,
you know, I think that's what's so compelling about Batman is that he is, you know, just a normal guy, or not a normal guy, but a human being without superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
So, all in all, are you going to go see it again at some point?
If somehow I can squeeze it in, I mean, wow, what an investment of time it is to go and see that again. But you know, I don't know that I've ever seen a Batman movie just once.
Right.
In the theater. This is a weird statistic that I was thinking about, the number of times I've seen all of them. Do you know which Batman I've seen the most number of times in theaters?
The one that you've seen the most in theaters. I'm going to say it was probably Batman Forever.
No, but you're on the right track. Batman Returns, the one with DeVito and Michelle Pfeiffer, and that's one of my least favorite.
Yeah, I saw that one a lot, too.
Right. I think it was just we were at that age where we had a little disposable income, and we had the freedom to be able to go.
Right.
And we were like, let's go see this like 10 more times. But yeah, I really didn't care for that one all that much. I think it was just like, Batman on the big screen, I'm going. Batman on the big screen for 11 minutes.
Right. Yeah, yeah. That's the total amount in this film. So it's interesting that this film, I didn't feel like it had a lot of Batman in it. So, but the other characters are so compelling, and I love seeing Bane, that it's, you know, and the exposition of the whole story, that I will go see it again. Of course, I thought it was, you know, an amazing film. But the one I've seen two of them equal amounts of time. The 1989 Batman and The Dark Knight. I saw, I think, four times each in the theater, in different variations. So, you know, will you go see it in IMAX again? I thought it was actually – so there were quite a few scenes that were shot in IMAX, well over an hour of the film. And you can totally tell. There's certainly – I think it certainly added to the drama of the film being that large.
Yeah, to be sure. Yeah, it did. It gave it that epic scale, and – especially those like huge mob scenes, or I wish I would have seen it as it was happening, like that football stadium scene.
Right.
Like, those are the kind of things that really benefit from the IMAX, or IMAX as it's known, experience.
Yeah, I can't wait to go see it again. So what do we have to look forward to next? God.
Well, I can tell you something that's coming up here on the Grizzly Bear Cafe. In the very near future, Clayton and I will get to interview jazz siren Jane Monheit. Here on the program. That is coming to a Grizz near you in the very, very near future. And while there isn't a whole lot on the superhero movie agenda going forward until we get into 2013, really. But wow, 2013 is loaded. Starts early, too. I know the first one was rotten, and I've talked about how rotten it was here on the Grizz, but I'm so going to see G.I. Joe Retaliation. I'm absolutely going to go see it.
It's so funny. You have a little bit of an affinity for that film. I was surprised, even though it was I've not seen the first one.
Right. It is. It's not good, but it's something about G.I. Joe, the way that factored into our childhood.
Right.
It's the same way. Like, you know they're going to make another lousy Transformers movie, and I'll probably see it. And I will probably even go and see this horrific-sounding Ninja Turtles movie that they're going to make, because those are properties from my childhood that I love. And, yeah, I'm absolutely – like, all I had to say was, you know, the villain in the new G.I. Joe is Firefly, who's, like, one of my very, very favorite Cobra characters. And I thought, I'm going to that.
Yeah, but what is it about this film, though, that you don't mind, but you certainly would mind the Transformers films, the Michael Bay films? I mean, I just think they're atrocious.
Right.
But compared to – I mean, maybe is there something about the G.I. Joe films that is less atrocious?
Yeah, I think they are less atrocious than the Michael Bay ones. There is something really offensive about everything Michael Bay makes. It's just so crass and poorly done. Like, G.I. Joe was poorly done, but I didn't think it was crass. Like, I didn't feel like it lacked heart. Like, it might have been at times, and it's definitely true, that first G.I. Joe movie, it was at times a little stupid. But there's something really crass about the Michael Bay Transformers movie. I think we talked about that when we had Stan Bush on the program. Like, they're heartless in a way. You just don't care. Like, he doesn't understand. They aren't just interchangeable robots distinguished by their paint jobs. Like, they have distinct personalities and things like that, and none of that comes through in the Michael Bay Transformers movies. None of it.
And yet, what, the most recent one, I guess the second one, was like one of the third highest grossing films of
of all time.
Yeah.
Right? Shattered box office records. The second one's the lousiest of the entire thing, and they did crazy box office numbers, which is the whole reason they're going to make a fourth one. But, yeah, I don't know. I'm willing to give G.I. Joe a little more rope to hang itself with. And then, of course, as we discussed last week on The Grizz, next summer we've got Iron Man, right? Iron Man 3. We have Thor 2. And there's another one, too. Oh, and The Wolverine, right, is next summer, as well as The Man of Steel. So five huge kind of in that wheelhouse of The Grizz type.
I'm excited about that. You know, I was worried. Here we are. I mean, Batman has always been my favorite. And so now I'm saddened a bit that this is the end of that. I just hope, though, that someone else doesn't pick it up and do a Spider-Man in 3 years.
Right, that they jettison what's been built in favor of what they want to do.
Right. I almost hope that Nolan comes back for a fourth one, you know? His arms get twisted enough that someone says, come back and do something again, you know?
Yeah. He's probably not hurting for money.
Right. But I'm just sad that it's done. I thought this was, to me, this is how every superhero film, you know, this is sort of the template going forward. If you're going to do a superhero film, you look to what Nolan did with with Batman as a way to do it right. And I'm sad. I'm sad that it's done, you know. But there's enough. I'm excited about Man of Steel because at least I know he has his hands in that. And from what I've seen of it, I'm thinking, wow, this is a complete sort of reinterpretation of this iconic character that I'm looking forward to. And it may have a little of that Nolan Batman taint on it that I can be excited about.
Right on. Hey, I want to take a moment here and thank the loyal members of the Egghead Army who have checked in and left us positive 5-star reviews in iTunes lately. Ryan Egan dropped off a 5-star review in the last month for us, writing, "This show is really fantastic with great guests and hilarious banter. Right you are, Ryan." Thank you for dropping that off for us. Long time, he's always tweeting us, Eric Hofstetter is. In fact, I was tweeting with him just this morning, I believe. He said he loves these guys and he loves the show with lots of exclamation points, and that's how people know that he's sincere about that. Aaron Carson also left us a 5-star review over in the iTunes store, which is where we would appreciate you doing the same. He writes, "Each week I eagerly await the subliminal commands from the Egghead Army's general staff. Having long ago become a Michael Nesmith fan, purchasing the Amazing Zigzag concert box set, and doing whatever else they tell me to go buy, I eagerly recommend this podcast in hopes that the Egghead Army might swell in numbers. Thank you, Aaron Carson, for your 5-star review." And very, very recently, Keith Vinzant, or Vinzant? That's a great last name, Vinzant.
Yeah.
He serves right under Emperor Zurg. He said he's been listening to us for a couple of years now. The banter back and forth is compelling. It makes for a very entertaining show, which is why I keep coming back. Thank you, Keith. And we will mispronounce your name if you go to the iTunes store and leave us a positive 5-star review. But those 4.5 ones, guess what? I won't. I'm not going to say your name. I won't do it. 5-star is the minimum I will accept.
Yeah, it's a minimum. You can't do anything less than Eric Hoff, who you mentioned had written a nice review for us on iTunes, and also was tweeting us this week about he and his son building a Batarang, which was quite awesome, by the way. I don't know if you saw the black duct tape pictures. Go to our Twitter stream, Grizzly Bear Cafe. You can check out what Eric and his son built, these awesome Batarangs out of black duct tape and cardboard. And he used one of those sharp X-Acto knives to get it exactly perfect. These things look just like they were out of the film. Good job, Eric. And thanks for listening, as always. So that's going to do it this week. Hey, yeah, we're going to talk to Jane Meinheit, a jazz singer. I'll be excited to hear what she's up to lately. And I think she's got an album that came out late last year. She's been on tour. A beautiful, beautiful voice. Brush up on your Jane Meinheit. Download some jazz stuff. You will be thankful that you did. We'll chat with her.
Yeah, stick with the newer stick with the older albums, her first 2 or 3, and not so much the most recent stuff. And that may even be a topic of conversation when we get Ms. Meinheit on the line.
Indeed it will.
Hey, is there anybody we forgot to thank? I feel like we're overlooking one of our awesome sponsors.
Oh, well, we do have one more we should round out the show with, and we want to thank them for being with us for so long. This will be the last time they're with us for a few months as we end the summer doldrums here for trading in your used electronics, but our friends over at Gazelle.com.
Mm-hmm.
So Gazelle.com, you know how they work, right? You go there, you type in what gadget you have. If you've got an old camera, you've got an old iPod, you've got something in your drawer you want to get rid of, an old cell phone, you just type in what you have at Gazelle.com, and they'll give you a quote for it. They'll say, hey, you know what? We're going to pay you $80 for that old camera. Wow, that's better than it collecting dust or winding up in a landfill. Yeah, I'll take that $80. And then what they'll do is they'll email you a shipping label. So all you do, you print it out, slap it on a box, they'll pay the shipping, you send it to them, and then they're going to give you cash for your used electronics. They're going to email you every step of the way to let you know that, hey, we received your gadget, everything's in working order. And they'll give you an extra 5% back, too, if you check out and get the Amazon gift card option. They'll give you an extra 5% back. So if you're going to buy stuff on Amazon anyway, why not just get the extra 5%, right? God, I buy so much stuff on there, why not do it, you know? Mm-hmm. So check them out. We want to thank them so much for their support of this at the Grizzly Production, this show and many shows at Grizzly Productions. It's been wonderful having them on board. And if anyone is interested in sponsoring an episode of the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe, you can always reach us at grizzlyproductions.tv. We reach tens of thousands of people around the world, and we have a loyal audience here, and we're just really appreciative of the audience and the sponsors that we've had here on the show.
Mm-hmm. The exact number is 2 million.
Right.
Exactly. 2 million people.
Mike's always right.
I am. That's right. The mic is right. Well, that's going to do it for the Grizzly Bear Egg Cafe. You can catch us other places. Of course, Clayton's on Fox and Friends on the Fox News Network every single weekend. He is on live television for 412 hours every single weekend without taking a potty break, which is amazing. I don't know how you pull it off. The answer is depends. You can also catch me. I team up with Clayton's wife when he's not around on The Trending Show, which comes out every Sunday. We talk about the top trending topics in Google and on Twitter, so stay in the know. At least that's how I do. On The Trending Show, I'm also over on Daddy on Board, a parenting podcast. Listen at your peril. These and other great programs await you at grizzlyproductions.tv.
Indeed. We will see you.
Okay, bye now.